You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome to Here District. We also call it the Fantastic Boys, a song that was written by my cousin, Fred Alexander, of Lakeside. Used to be Lakeside Express, but then they kind of morphed into Lakeside. First mate, Chris Johnson. So we're on this fantastic voyage. I'm the captain of this vessel. And that's my first mate, Chris Johnson. Man, we are so honored to have, God, I mean, this guy's really good at what he does. I really respect his presence, his opinion, and everything else about him. Bomani Jones. Bomani Jones, welcome to Here District, man. Welcome to this fantastic voyage.
I appreciate it. And I did not know that you were related to the Lakeside fellas. Yeah, I was Fred, not up on that.
Fred Alexander. That's I think that's cousin Faye's nephew or something. I forgot how it works out, but yeah.
The degrees of separation in L.A. are so small. Like, I got a buddy who always talks about how he wants to do something on really, like, those first two generations of migrants to L.A. Because when you realize it, the numbers aren't really that big, but the output is absurd.
Facts. Well, we were part of that mass migration that came from Louisiana in the early 60s. And I like to say that our house in South Central Los Angeles, Bomani, was like a way station. You know, there was a secret knock that you had to have to get in, you know, and the bloodhounds were barking and the cousins would come in and hide out for a month and get themselves together. And my dad had one rule. You could stay with us for however long it took to get yourself together, but you had to have a job. You had to have a job and kind of carry your own weight but we were that family. We were that family. Always had cousins sleeping on the divan, the pull out divan in the living room. Always might be three or four just big brothers, you know, big cousins. All first Clement, Lee Arthur, Theotis, Richard Jr. Yeah. You know, they were and I had no brothers, Bomani, and so four sisters. So these were like my big brothers growing up. So I digress, man. But it's all good, man. It's a pleasure to have you, man. So I'm gonna start off with something, man, because it is kind of some corny shtick, but you're supposed to be this critical kind of knowledgeable guy of cultural. That's the word I'm looking for. Cultural stuff and everything going on. And so there's a bit of shtick that I'm going to do, and I want to see if you can recognize it. It's from one of my favorite documentaries, and it starts out holding some carrots and saying, I'm going to dub you the rabbit. You are hereby dubbed the rabbit. You know who said that, man? You know who said that?
I gotta be honest, I don't.
Let him train. I don't want to mess with your trainer. I just want you to know that from now on, you are the rabbit.
Yeah, I'll try to do his voice. Yeah, I will dub thee the rabbit because they say a rabbit is scared of his own shadow, and you are now officially the rabbit.
This sounds like some Ali.
Floyd Patterson will be no match. He's too short. He's too slow. He don't have the reach. He can't take a punch. He don't hit hard, and he don't have the footwork.
Good. Yeah. Joe Frazier, man, come on.
No,
Chris.
Was he telling Joe Frazier that? Was he telling?
No, Joe he was telling Floyd Patterson that.
Oh, Floyd Patterson.
He went to Floyd Patterson's training camp like they used to do back in the day.
That's right.
Ali's got the carrot in his hand. I dubbed the rabbit. They say a rabbit, you know, when he gets scared, he just freezes up and doesn't move. And that's what you do in the ring when I get after you, Floyd. And so, the point being, now, not like you're, you know, Floyd Patterson, you freeze up when under pressure. But, man, I'm preparing for this interview. And so I'm going down the rabbit hole. This is what the rabbit thing is, rabbit reference. I go down this Bomani Babatunde Jones rabbit hole. Can you talk about, man, first of all, your mom and the Catch Drug Store and everything that she was a part of as a young woman growing up in Oklahoma? Just touch on that for us a bit, please.
Yo, it's actually interesting you mentioned that because in May of this year, 2024, my brother and I went with her to Norman because she's a graduate at University of Oklahoma, and they gave her an honorary degree, which is, you know, a height of honor at that university. It was interesting. The table next to me was the family of Toby Keith because he was getting one too. So, you know, they weren't playing around. They gave one, you know, gave the two of them at the same time. But no, my mother grew up in Oklahoma City. And I believe it was when she was 14, she went with a group of students to New York City. A lawyer in Oklahoma City named Clara Looper had written and produced a play that was playing in New York City. And they went for that. And that was the first time that those kids had ever been outside of the thumb of segregation. Like, it was the first time that they could go into the places they wanted to, order the things they wanted to, you know, and they got kind of a taste of that life. And what wound up happening was they came back to Oklahoma City, and that was the beginning of a sit-in movement that it comes after the movement in Wichita, Kansas, but before the Greensboro, Woolworth sit-ins that people typically think of as the first ones. And these were children, like the Kanye West songs. We hear him talk about his mom being the age of six and participating in sit-ins. These are the sit-ins that we're talking about. And my mother was the spokesperson slash leader of that group. And I learned a lot about it in May that I didn't know. And that basically they came into that store and demanded, you know, sat at the counters, demanded to be seated. They weren't seated. Of course, they were treated horribly by the people who were there. They came that first day, then they closed. And the second day, they came back. And I believe she said it was the third day that they came back. For the third day, they came back and they finally served them. And just like that, the store changed its policy. Mm. But what she told me that was interesting was that when she went to OU in 1960, they brought the movement with them. And so they then began to engage in sit-ins in Norman. Yeah. And they did the same thing at the biggest department store in Norman. So, you know, back in those days, the big department stores had cafeterias.
Right.
And so they were going into the cafeterias. The cafeterias had the counter. And so, you know, they were going in there and they were breaking them pretty quick in Oklahoma City. Like, once they realized that they was going to keep coming back every day, they finally just said, oh, well, we got to do something.
Yeah.
Man, she said in Norman, I can't believe it was a year and a half or 2 years, but they had to keep coming back for 2 years. And I was like, boy, that's a level of dedication. But they broke them, too.
I mean,
did that.
So just impressed to read how they just and so these kids that you talk about, your mom, Donda West, Kanye's mother was a part of that group. Claire Looper, I think, was the teacher's name or one of the orchestrators. But I mean, they were getting spit on. They were getting hit. Kick, push, abuse, and they kept coming back. I said, people don't get the full magnitude of kind of what these, you think of just, oh, they sit in and singing, we shall overcome. Now, they were getting physically abused, emotionally abused, you know, psychologically abused, and they kept coming back until they got served those Cokes that they had ordered, 13 Cokes or whatever it was they had ordered, and they got served those.
And I think she said when she sat down that she asked for a Coke and they said that we don't serve. I don't remember if they said black people in words, whichever one. And she said, that's great because I just asked for a Coke.
I don't drink black people. I don't drink in words. Yes.
Yeah, I don't need that, right? But something that was interesting also, so as my brother and I were walking around campus with her, like they did a real big for us, right? Like gave us a nice little campus tour and all of this. And she was talking about how the different levels of the sit-ins and to make that stuff work. And then one thing they did was eventually started getting people who were canceling their charge accounts, right? Because you used to have the charge cards, you know, for the stores. And another level of the pressure was to cancel the charge accounts. And what was so interesting for me and my brother is that we had both read this book by a professor named Kevin Cruz called White Flight. And it talked about how basically Atlanta was the template for the white flight movements in all these places. And it talks about all the steps of the desegregation of Atlanta. And one of the steps was to desegregate the department store in a very similar fashion. And Martin Luther King eventually got involved in it. His father had been involved in it. But as my mother was telling me the different steps of what they did in Oklahoma City, my brother and I both heard things that we had read in this book about these steps in Atlanta, which is to say, these kids didn't just do it there. They also provided a template and a blueprint for people to use in larger cities like Atlanta to begin to advance this movement.
And people don't understand or can't appreciate, let me put it that way. Like my dad, Jeff Johnson Jr., he was one of a group of young men in Natchitoches, Louisiana that sued to integrate Northwestern State University in Natchitoches, Louisiana. And Thurgood Marshall was a part of that lawsuit and all that. And they, you know, showed me some newspaper articles. But another story of my father, his best friend from 6 years old, Dr. Charles Mayfield, practicing physician. He couldn't practice in Natchitoches. Two races had to go to Shreveport. And the white people in Natchitoches were so, I don't know what the word is. So whatever it is, so they wanted to intimidate him. So they burnt the cross on his yard and all that when he go out of town during the week to practice medicine in Shreveport. So my dad and a group of his cohorts brandished shotguns and protected that family for like a week or 2 weeks straight. So every time the car would come by to try and intimidate, they see all these brothers out front with these shotguns. And so the intimidation stopped. So, I mean, just growing up in that kind of a household, that kind of a foundation for you, your dad, Mac Jones is an economics professor, or
what's his background? Well, my mother's an economics professor. My dad's a political science professor.
Okay, okay.
But he's from Louisiana, like you, and he got them stories. Like
yeah, his, yeah.
He was also involved in the sit-ins in Baton Rouge. I think it was the bus depot where we went down there. He got put out of school and all of that stuff. And he had one of the families like, that's the thing. Oklahoma was what it was, but Louisiana was a whole lot of you got guns, we got guns, and sometimes we got to show everybody. You know, sometimes you got to pop out. Like, there was definite out-popping that was taking place.
And that's the reputation of a lot of Louisiana African-Americans, blacks from that era was that, you know, they didn't take a whole lot of stuff. My dad didn't get a payment for some work he did. He went to the barn. This was an older white guy. And then my dad's name is Jeff. An older white guy was like, you know, what do you call him? Fred or something. They call him out of his name. You know, what are you doing here? You know, my dad pulled out the gun and said, I'm here for my money. And he got his money. You know, so those kinds of stories are prevalent. Okay, now see the T-shirt you're rocking today, the Tommy Smith, the John Carlos. And even that, is that the third place finisher was from where, Australia?
He was from Australia.
And he actually... People don't realize he participated in the protest too. I'm not sure. He had black socks. He had something. What did he do?
I think he had the black socks. He was down. And I always have to say, I'm actually in some ways like a little disappointed that he was down, because it's a lot more funny to imagine him standing up there just being like, what's going on?
Let me separate myself from these two.
Like, you imagine being the one white man and ain't nobody telling you they was about to do this. Australia, this ain't even really got nothing to do with you.
Right, Mike. What are you doing with these black gloves, Mike? What's going on here, Mike? Yeah.
But at the same time, being like, that gold medal might be mine.
No, that's
funny. That's the other part. You might come up.
Yeah. So this is a great segue because, and Chris can speak on this, man. And Chris, you were mentioning it to me earlier. The amount of flag bearers and people of color and all
well,
that.
Well,
stuff,
yeah, man. No, we were talking today, Bo, and just kind of making the observation. We got Dennis Schröder in Germany. He's the flag bearer. Giannis from Greece is the flag bearer. Coco Gauff, LeBron, they're flag bearers for USA. Just trying to get your take on where we're at, where we're at, where those countries are at. I never thought I'd see, you know, a Dennis Schröder or Giannis being flag bearers for Germany or Greece. What's your take on the flag bearer situation at the Olympics?
Especially Giannis.
I'll say this. I didn't know about Schröder until you just told me. And I'm kind of blown away because, I mean, let's be honest, man. He cool. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want to act like he can't hoop. I don't want to act like he ain't a dude that's been a contributor on some good teams. But I didn't know he was such a big thing in Germany that they was letting him carry the flag with that spot in his hair. And
he's a former skateboarder. He was a skateboarder. Yeah. He was discovering riding a skateboard. The basketball coach saw him ride a skateboard, do some tricks, and said, hey, you might be able to hoop a little bit.
What a legend.
Yo, you realize how wild it is to have a country where somebody got to see your black on a skateboard to get you to play basketball?
Doing tricks.
As an American, that is a wild concept that I cannot grasp. But I had no idea with him. Like, that one to me kind of speaks on, like, wow, the power of the NBA. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And the power of Dirk, honestly, because he is of the legacy of Dirk. Now, with Giannis, of course, what we know about the fact that the man was literally born without a country, right? With no passport, stateless, carrying a name on his back that isn't like actually his name, like to the point where I don't actually know I know how to say his name in real life, but it's not the one that's written down. So people who don't know, his name is Adetobunko, I believe, but they changed it to make it fit like the Greek phonics. And that's why it's Antetokounmpo. But the man didn't have a passport and now is the flag bearer at the Olympics for Greece.
And just seeing the Greek flag out there makes me want to play harder, makes me want to do even more for my country and for my team.
I wonder like how complex that is for him, because I don't know, like my daddy would have been like, keep your flag, I ain't carrying nothing. But at the same time, I can imagine the level of pride to know that you did so much to get to this point, that you are the representative of a country that as recently as 11 years ago would not give you a passport. He did not have a passport when he got drafted. Like, that is a crazy thought.
Right. But then Giannis too, calling and saying, "I need my parents here. When are they coming?" There was only one question that came. It wasn't like, "How you doing?" or "What's going on?" It was, "When are my parents coming?"
And I think that it speaks to sort of where Giannis is at, and he's appreciative of Greece. If Giannis, The Marvelous Journey, the movie, they break it down in detail about his experience over there with his brothers, the racism they experienced, everything they experienced, the highs, the lows. I got the feeling, the takeaway was that they really feel indebted to Greece, the government, the culture, for embracing them, for everything they've done for their family. I remember a situation when you were talking about the passport. I believe it was Senator Herb Cole that called John Kerry, Secretary of State, yeah. made a call and, you know, hooked it up to where people got to travel and things like that happened. So I understand the level of gratitude and his, like, earnest in representing his country with pride, playing the Olympics despite being injured. Like, I get everything that he's on.
Yeah. His story is, you know, a movie's been made about it, but it's a different era now where I don't think that resonates in the way that it would have. But this is like, this is really one of the more incredible stories yes. in sports. Like, it's that weird draft 2013 that was one of the worst drafts ever, except for the fact that Giannis is in it. Right? Like, Giannis and Rudy Gobert wind up being the dudes that you pull out of this, but there, Jokic is a similar case. Mm. Ain't nobody know it was going to be like this, right? Like, there's every now and then there's somebody, like, what's his name? Ja Morant is really interesting. Before his sophomore year, I went to find, like, who saw this coming? And literally one person on the whole internet saw it coming. He was a college student. I want to say his name was Jackson Hoy. You want to guess where he works? The Memphis Grizzlies. But there was literally one person who saw what was coming with him.
Right,
was no one person who saw this with Giannis. No. He just came out here and he did this. He made this happen. Somebody took Kelly Olynyk over him.
Wow. that pretty much says all you need to say.
And by the way, not just somebody, one of the best executives in the NBA.
Right.
Looked at him and was like, yeah, I'd be able to move him off too easy. Give me Kelly Olynyk.
What executive was that? I
Danny Ainge.
Oh, it was Danny Ainge. Okay. That's right. He started out in Boston. Kelly.
He was in Boston.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. You know, he's kind of bounced around a lot over the years, but and that speaks to Danny Ainge's Danny Ainge has done a good job. I can't knock him, but and like you say, it wasn't a whole lot of people. The Bucks, who actually flew over there a few times and were kind of looking at Giannis, John Hammond, in terms of his future, even John Horst, the current guy. I mean, it was a crapshoot. Nobody knew. When I got there 10 years ago, when Giannis was about 19, about to turn 20, he wasn't an all-star yet. And I thought if he averaged 17-9, it'd be a really good year. He turned out to be one of those dudes. And nobody had any clue. And Jason Kidd was saying how his last name was going to prevent him from being named to the All-Star team. And I was like, no, his last name's going to help him because people are going to be like that funny name Greek dude. Right. But nobody knew, man. And nobody predicted that.
Let me tell you something. One of my favorite NBA stories always is the Cavs took LeBron James and Ricky Davis looked at it like, finally, they're getting me some help. Right. Like that. That still to me is the most amazing window into the mind state and the psyche of the NBA player, because Ricky Davis, what people don't realize is, and Chris, you have a similar age. So you do. Ricky Davis was a LeBron James type of player.
No, that's my guy, too. He was out in L.A. with us both. So he was 18, 19 years old. He went pro at an early age and he was a killer. He was a killer.
My brother saw Ricky Davis dunk on Brad Lowhouse in a summer league game in Iowa when Ricky Davis was 15 years old.
I'm trying to tell you.
He thought that they got me some help. But legitimately, they took Giannis first, but Giannis was supposed to be there to help Jabari. Mm. Jabari was supposed to be the guy, right? Yeah. The Bucks thought they were drafting a guy from Chicago, somebody who wanted to be there, could be a 15-year superstar, and we all thought that he was going to wind up being a superstar. And instead, it was Giannis.
Yeah, and Jabari, to his defense, I mean, he was averaging about 20-7, 20-8 that year. He got the really devastating knee injury, or the second one, or whatever. I mean, he was on his way.
It wasn't his fault. Like, he's nothing wrong with him.
Facts. Yeah.
But this other dude turned out to be something else.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. And so now, sticking with the Olympics, I'm listening to Gil's Arena and my son Josiah's on that show, and everybody's talking about, why are we playing the Olympics? Let's just hand the gold to the United States right now. I don't know. I think it'll be a lot more competitive, obviously, than that. But what's your take on the U.S. team, and who's going to be their toughest opponent? And do you think the road to the gold, how difficult will it be for them?
So it is possible that they can lose, right? Because this country overreacts when this basketball team loses. Like, when you go back and look at those disaster years, like 2004, you lost to Puerto Rico. Like, you can't lose to your colonies, dog.
No,
you
dog.
You can't explain.
No,
you
dog.
You can't explain losing to the colonies, right? But they lost games by like 4 points, 3 points, 7 points or whatever, and we blew the whole thing up. When they lost in 1988 to the Soviet Union with Sabonis, They lost that game by like 4 points or something like that. It doesn't take much for us to turn this whole thing over. But this team is constructed kind of interestingly. And yeah, they can lose. Like, we saw them almost lose a game to South Sudan. You can say they're playing with lineups and experimenting. But I think the most difficult question for them to answer is going to be how exactly you use Embiid. Because Embiid is really good if it's a team that's built around Joel Embiid. But the ball sticks when he gets it. He doesn't move it fast. And this type of ball needs to move fast. All that flopping don't work over there. Like, that's a man's game that they play. That's going to be the question. But to me, the team you don't want to see, to me, it seems very obvious that it's France, right? It's the bump that you get from playing at home on top of the fact that, I mean, I haven't heard you guys talk about it. I imagine at this point there's not a lot of arguing to do about this, but we're just counting down the days until Victor is the best player in the NBA, and it wouldn't surprise me if it's by the end of next year that he's the best player in the NBA.
Damn. Yeah. No, you're right on point with that. And you know, they've got some solid guys around him also. The thing that concerns me, Chris, I want your take on this too, is it just seems like it's combustible. This U.S. team, you got Anthony Edwards, you know, when Steve Kerr says, you know, D-Wade and somebody else came off the bench for Kobe, and his response was, well, we ain't got Kobe, you know, just in terms of the minutes distribution, in terms of guys accepting roles, and if there is some adversity that surfaces, now that's when all these issues become magnified. So, I don't know. I'm getting the sense that there's some disgruntlement in that lineup right now that Steve Kerr is going to have a challenge successfully managing.
But isn't that what LeBron's for? Isn't that what, like, these elder statesmen, Steph, is for, to get things together within the lineup, within that locker room? Everybody's on the same page. I agree with what you're saying, MJ, but I think one of the bigger problems offensively is, like, when we talk about the ball sticking, it's like there's not a flow that's out there that's conducive for Steph Curry. For me, I would be trying to build stuff and get that Golden State flow going so Steph can get in his rhythm, and then we operate out of Steph. Like, I've always been a LeBron guy, but I'm also a realist. In an international game, in my opinion, USA would be better running everything off of through Steph and then moving it more instead of this kind of stagnant ball-sticking offense. But that's why I'm not
To your point before you respond, Bomani, I was watching the South Sudan game, and LeBron had a possessions that started in the backcourt. I counted 16 dribbles. Yeah. And then he finally isolated this guy on the left elbow and took him to the basket and got a layup. But 16 dribbles. And to your point, I mean, that's not really conducive to what we think of as
the
fluid Golden State style of basketball. But Bomani, you jump in.
Well, one thing is, it's hard to have a team with LeBron that isn't built around LeBron. Like, there's some things like James Harden. It don't matter what you do, before you know it, it's going to be 7 seconds left on the shot clock, and James Harden going to be at the top of the key dribbling the ball between his legs, right? Like, it just goes that way. And that's not a knock on LeBron, but that's typically the way it runs. But something I hadn't really thought about until you said it there is, because the U.S. has so many dudes that are that good, I imagine these other countries are more likely to say, okay, we're running it through this guy, right? The U.S., you got more egos to balance and everything else. And so we really get off on the idea of quote-unquote team basketball and ping-ponging around and everything else. But you're right. Chances are they should probably run it through somebody like Steph. And does Steph even know what it's like anymore to play in an offense where the ball's not being run through Steph?
No, he doesn't.
That's what I guess all those guys have to learn.
Yeah. And I think the saving grace for the U.S., and I think we saw it against the South Sudan, as well as they played, Carlic Jones had the triple-double, just showed that he – you know, looked like he belonged someplace in the NBA. But that last shot he took didn't get close. He shot that bad boy almost over the rim, and he was knocking down that. So I'm saying he's seeing LeBron. He's seeing Steph. He's hearing KD on the bench. Brick, that you ain't got nothing. You weak. I just think that and then Wenyen Gabriel, the follow dunk, he was right there for the putback. He kind of bobbled it a little bit. He had Anthony Davis inside Embiid, whoever it was. I still think, and even with Canada, as good as they look, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and all these, they still got a lot of the Trey Lyles, the Trey Lyles role players that play a lot of minutes, and just the star power for the U.S. I think will be a big difference come crunch time in games down the stretch.
Yeah, I think that the advantage the European teams have in particular, because like the South Sudan squad kind of felt like an AAU team.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, can you play? You got your papers? All right, cool. Come on through. If you ain't got no papers, don't worry. They ain't going to ask. Right? You know, like, you just come on down. But those European squads and, like, South American teams where them dudes have been playing together forever, damn, Scola's still out here, if I'm not mistaken.
Like, Luis Scola? Scola?
I played against Scola.
Scola's still balling?
In France. I played against Scola in France, Bo. I played against Scola in, like, 2000 and doggone 4.
Hey, look, Scola, like, if Scola's playing, you're like, look, homie, I'm still, like, one of the best players in Argentina.
It's unbelievable. Right.
Well, and like, okay,
it doesn't look like he's playing anymore, but them dudes be playing together forever.
Oh,
look,
20, 30 years.
Jokic in 2016, them boys at Serbia took it down to the last shot in the gold medal game. Facts, and that's when we didn't know who Jokic was.
Yeah. Facts. Yeah. And they, and Bogdan Bogdanovic, you know, I love him. I mean, you know, he's underrated under the radar. You know, he's going to help them out a lot. And so it's going to be, I think, more competitive than what people think. But I just think the star power for the U.S., despite all the potential issues that Steve Kerr has to micromanage, I think they'll be okay, man. I think they'll be fine. And the
worst thing about it for him, though, man, they only talk about you coaching and the Olympic team when you mess up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When you win, you're supposed to win. Roll the balls out, all that talent, you know, coaching. What
it
coaching?
Sucks.
Yeah, but when you mess up,
it sucks.
The scope is on you when you mess up. And finally, can't let you get away without you just opining on the Milwaukee Bucks, the moves they've made during the offseason, DeLon Wright and Taurean Prince and
Gary Trent Jr.,
which I love. And then the East and how other teams, the Sixers, the Knicks, where do you see the Bucks kind of fitting in right now? And I know it's early. I know we don't know yet how it's going to come together with all these teams. But what are your impressions of the Bucks and the move they made?
Yeah, so I think, to me, part of it is personnel, right? And, like, adding those guys helps because you're going to need some measure of depth in the East at this point. It's about how much Chris Middleton has left, in a different way, kind of how much Dame has left. Not that he's at the end or injury riddled or whatever, but he's at that age and he's at that size that it's just like every year you have to assume that the guy that you saw last year was a little better than the guy that you're going to get in the year after. Like, I think the Bucks did what they should have done. They made the big move to go get Dame. But I feel like in some ways they kind of wound up in that situation, not dissimilar to when Cleveland signed LeBron in 2014, and then they made the Kevin Love move, and they're like, yo, we got this. And then they look up and the Warriors win 67 games. Like, none of us thought that the Celtics were going to roll out what may go down as one of the best teams in NBA history, right? Okay. Like, none of us saw that. Are they going to be as good the next year? But I just think it really comes down to Giannis and Dame, as this goes, figuring out exactly how to do this with one another. And if they can do this, if you were to ask me in the East, the top of a roster, the top two guys you want me to take, I think it's still them above everybody else's top two guys. I'd definitely take them over Embiid and Maxey, for example.
Yeah, or Brunson and whoever. Yeah.
So you're not giving Embiid and PG? You're not giving Embiid and Paul George?
I've gone about as far as I can on this Embiid thing. Like, at some point, the question is it you?
Yeah. Facts. Yeah. Right. And to that point, now, and I've heard a lot of people talk about Drew Holiday and that trade for that involved with Dame and how the Bucks made the biggest mistake and a colossal mistake. Please address that for our listeners out there.
The version of Drew Holiday that you saw in Boston was not the version of Drew that we saw at the end in Milwaukee. And a big part of why he could be what he was for Boston and he wasn't for Milwaukee is that Boston did not ask him to do nearly as much offensively. I want to say he was coming in with a usage under 20%.
Like, fifth highest on the team.
Yeah, fifth. Right. If you got a team where you're just asking him to be sturdy and play defense, like, somehow Boston is able to pay all these dudes all this money to the point where they can ask Kristaps Porzingis and Drew Holiday to be like $30 million a year role players and then go give Derek White the $30 million a year also. So, no, this happens sometimes. It was a better fit for him for what was going on in Boston. But they tell you, especially after the way that it ended in 2023, you can get Dame Lillard, but you got to give up Drew Holiday. You know you're giving up the defense. Nobody's disputing that, right?
Yeah.
What got Griffin in trouble was he couldn't figure out how to fix the defense quick enough. Like, people needed to know that it was going to happen. But no, this was the move, and the professional thinkers are going to have to figure out how to cook up a defense. Now, you can say whatever you want about Doc. Doc has historically been good at putting guys around him who can cook up stuff. Facts. Right? He had Tom Thibodeau running the defense before, right? You can have, like, go through all the different guys that he's had, and they're just going to have to figure out how to come up with a strong defense with Dame Lillard at the point. I know it's not the easiest thing in the world, but you're still going to have Brooke Lopez and Giannis behind him. I think you can figure something out.
Yeah, and to that point, with Drew Holiday, I mean, and I love Drew, L.A. guy. I've been watching him since Campbell Hall days in high school. But he was matched up against Jimmy Butler in the playoffs the year before. And Jimmy outscored him 38 points a game to 18. And it was like a 20-point differential because the rules were different. You can't touch anybody. And so that made Drew's point of attack, physical defense, not passe, but a little less effective. Then all of a sudden, Joe Dumars comes in January and says, yeah, it's a little bit too much scoring going on when you got the Pacers setting – you know, NBA right. records for points per possession. So now you can play defense again. You can get physical again. And so Dame's free throws attempts goes down from 9 a game to like 5 a game, the biggest drop off of anybody in the league. So at the time they made the trade, my point is, it was the right thing to do. Get offensive minded. Get you a guy that can get you some buckets. Yeah. And Dame has admitted he was not in shape. He didn't play a lot of basketball because he didn't know where he was going to wind up, didn't want to risk injury. So I expect things to be a lot different coming into this season. Yeah.
Well, also for him, and I understand, and it's not unreasonable, our expectations that you just figure out how to get it done when you're a professional athlete and we don't ask that many questions, like, about the rest of that stuff, right? But at the same time, I have moved on, like, 2 weeks' notice and been expected to get to work right fast, and all that was moving was me. It's not that big a deal, right? Like, Dame got his whole family moved out there to Portland, been there for all those years, all of that stuff, you know, family, immediate and otherwise, like, all of these things. Yeah, it's gonna be a little trickier. Like, baseball's the one sport where, like, a guy gets divorced or a guy's got something going on at home and it turns up in the numbers. Everywhere else, you just be like, I don't know, he just ain't playing that well, right?
Right,
I'm
yeah.
sure that it's a bit sturdier for him yeah. this year. Like, he'll come in a different situation. But I mean, look, everybody looking at Doc, the world down on Doc. I think people are too hard on Doc. I think Doc is in what I call the Scottie Pippen zone, where people either think you're overrated or underrated, but nothing in between. And there are arguments to be made on both sides. But he's a good coach. I think that part is fair and clear. We're going to find out what it comes down to in the postseason. But he has demonstrated by and large that he'll cook something up for those 82 games.
And to that point, and I've watched this up close and personal, and trust me, I'm watching, trying to see, because you're hearing all the naysayers talk about Doc and all that. Doc's ability to be specific player to player in terms of what he's expecting. Mm. And as a player, that's, you know, we always say that's all you could ask. Tell me what you want me to do. And let there be no gray area. Let me know what. So he goes from player to player. The Nassas bring that energy in practice. You're not going to play a lot, but we need that energy pumping guys up off the bench. Pat Connaughton, you become this real estate magnate in Milwaukee. Give me that same energy you put in the real estate on the basketball floor. I mean, I'm speaking out of school here, but that's okay. It's supposed to. But every player, he goes down the line. Right after the All-Star break, I think we're in Portland or somewhere, and he tells every player exactly what's expected of them. Actually, it was Minneapolis, what's expected of them. And when I saw that, and I saw some of the adjustments he's made in practice, some of the stuff he's done in game, talking to him, you know, on the side, Doc's a hell of a coach. Yeah. You don't last in this league, whatever it's been, 20 years, whatever it's been for Doc, and not know what you're doing. Please. I mean, just by accident.
Thanks.
As long as he keeps playing it straight with him, it'll be all right.
Yeah,
and that's
what
we all know. It is nothing easier to do than lose a basketball team. Yeah, you can lose a basketball team with one. I mean, you saw what happened to the last dude. He ain't even get 30 games.
Yeah,
you can lose a basketball team like this. I'm not saying that's right or that's wrong. It's just the truth.
Well, you know what that's about? See, that's about players having the sensitivity of being around this game for so long that you know when a guy knows what he's doing and you know when he does it. You know when he's just flying by the seat. And not to say Adrian Griffin was flying by the seat of his pants, but he was placed in a tough position as a first-time head coach with a team that's expected to challenge for a championship.
Tough.
And so now that's added pressure. It's tough. It's tough. Yeah. And I think the players sensed that and sensed that the pressure and all that was a little bit overbearing. And at a certain point, to your point, Bomani, he lost the team. He lost the team. And
when the players tell you it's time for a new coach, that means it's time for a new coach. You may not know it yet. Players don't fire coaches. Players let you know that it's time to fire the coach.
Yeah,
it's a different thing, right? Like college, it's a little bit different, right? You know, be careful with them taxi receipts. Everybody else, you just they will tell you when it's time to get fired.
Listen, man, I played for the Clippers, and we were masters at getting coaches fired. We didn't get back on defense. We didn't talk. You know, we did just little things that you can do on the court. And I actually did a thing with Fox Sports, the Fox Scope, and I showed how the Lakers were about to get rid of Dale Harris. You could see that getting back in transition. Five guys still in the offensive end. You know, just little fake hustle type stuff that I pointed out that showed that to the untrained eye, you'd never notice it. But when you're watching it, you know these guys have quit on this coach.
And in the media part is where they start telling writers stuff like this. Just write what you see. They're not trying to maneuver it. They're not trying to call it anything else. They're like, attention needs to be brought to what is happening here. Just write what you see.
And finally, man, Bomani, there was an article on my former teammate, Junior Bridgman. I got a great story about that. When he was about to invest in Wendy's, he came to me and said, man, you want to come in with me? I said, what's the product? He said, Wendy's hamburger. It's like, brother, ain't nobody going to eat those square hamburgers. You're going to lose all your daggone money invested in square hamburgers, because there wasn't no square hamburgers.
Way to go, Dad.
$800 million in a private jet later, you know. But great article in ESPN and just – give us some insights in terms of your feelings about that.
Well, first of all, I did not realize he was that rich until, I guess, a year ago. I can't remember if this went public. It was a purchase he was looking at making. And somebody was like, yeah, the guy that's trying to buy this, he says his name was Bridgman. And I was like, Junior? And he said, yeah. And so, like, Bridgman's always been a bit of a fascinating figure to me because they made that trade for Kareem in 1975. But the Bucks did okay in that trade, right? Yeah. Like they got back two guys whose numbers they retired. Like, you know,
Dave Myers was one of those guys from UCLA also. Yeah.
Like, I mean, look, you ain't getting back Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but I always thought that they had done all right. And so the story came out and it was interesting, but I read it and it was a good story, you know, and it's about him getting his money through all that stuff. But the way they put it was that how he went from journeyman to, you know, $600 million. And I was like, I said on Twitter, I was like, hey, man, I don't think you a journeyman when they retire your number. Right. Yes, and you only played for two teams. Like, I don't feel like that qualifies as a journeyman. And I'll be to fairness to ESPN. Apparently, they decided I was correct because they changed it to six man, which he was. He was a 14 point a game six man. Right. A very Don Nelson. I say, I guess you both you and he very perfect for a Don Nelson forward thinking basketball.
Facts. Yeah. And one of the greatest just all around people that I've ever been around in Junior Bridgman. And he had that one year, man. A couple of things. He averaged 17 a game one year. And I think that was the year 1979-80 when we lost to the Sonics in seven games. And he played the first game or two before a foot injury sidelined him. And we had a 3-2 lead. We blew it at home. But that, to me, was that window for us to, you know, to get to the finals. And it just goes to show that, you know, health is probably the most important factor. But, yeah, Junior Bridgman, man, doing the thing. And I was just with him a couple of weeks ago in Louisville. My daughter was playing in the AAU tournament. And, you know, I asked him if I could stay at the compound for a couple of days. And not only did he allow me to stay at the compound, but he went to her games, two of her games. This is Junior Bridgman, you know, billionaire. And he hosted an elaborate dinner, about 20 people from friends and family that he knew, for my daughter Shiloh at the compound, and just made her feel so special, man. So, I mean, he's a one-of-a-kind individual. And if anybody is worth that kind of adulation, it's Junior Bridgman for the kind of dude that he is. So, man, thanks for speaking on him, man.
But, Em, your retirement, just to add on top of that, your retirement. When the Bucks retired his jersey, Uncle Junior hooked it up, Bo, like you wouldn't believe, for everybody in Milwaukee. We were just riding around like kings, so we appreciate it all.
That man got $600 million, and it could have been you.
Yeah, yeah.
Square hamburgers, bruh.
Yeah, square hamburgers. Yeah, I should have. Yeah, square hamburgers. Yeah, well.
Did you know why they square? They square so you get a burger in every bite.
That's what it is. And quickly, before we let you go, they talk about in the article how he invested $150,000 in our owner, Jim Fitzgerald's cable company. And once that sold 5 years later, he came out with $700,000. Well, I got that same opportunity, but I had just renegotiated with the Bucks. And my parents were like, that white man just wants his money back. Don't you go into that investment. That white man, he just tried to get all that money you got off of him because you held out. He mad at you for holding out. And so,
Grandma.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, that was Grandma.
Grandma.
That white man, he just wants his money back.
You trying to put your black on the game. Here you are. Everybody else. That white, let me tell you, when you walked out of there, that white man was like, okay, he don't see.
But the final point with my mother, I was going through some financial difficulties about 5, 6, 7 years ago or more. And I went to my mom. I was like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm kind of running out of money. And so my mom said, what about your IRA? I was like, who? IRA? Who's IRA? She's like, your individual retirement account. We put a whole lot of money away for you when we was managing your money back in your plan days. And I had like a couple of $1 million that my parents had socked away for me that I did not know. I'm getting teary-eyed thinking about it. That my parents had socked away for me for this rainy day that came up and kind of kept it kept it away from me until I got myself together. And so anyway, I just wanted to make sure
I got that period. Tell you. This made me ask some questions about how you was living to where your mama never told you. She knew this day was coming. She knew one day I'm going to have to be like, ta-da, millions of dollars.
Here you go, $2 million. If I knew me better than anybody. Knew me better than I knew myself,
yes,
as a matter of fact.
Yes,
and it's a good thing she did. But Monty Jones, man, we thank you so much. We appreciate you, brother, and keep doing what you do.
I appreciate you having me. Y'all being Chris. I guess, man, Chris, we go back now about 15 years now.
Yes, sir.
Magic.
Yes, sir.
From all of this stuff. No, yes. This is an honor for me to be able to be on here, and if it didn't go well, I was gonna say, nah, it's cool. Shoot everybody.
Oh man, that's it. Appreciate you, brother.
For love of the game.
There's nothing like being selected to the Olympic team.
And love of their country.
Championship of that level, gold medal, means more.
Tune into Behind the Bucks on the Bucks Plus Audio Network. Inside stories from Bucks stars on the agony and triumph of competing to win it all at the Olympics. It's Behind the Bucks, presented by Gallagher, your trusted insurance broker and HR and benefits consultant. Available now on Bucks.com/plus, the Bucks app, and streaming wherever you get your podcast.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
Hey, I'm the captain of this vessel. It's the Pier District, and it's the Fantastic Voyage. Captain Marcus Johnson, First Mate Chris Johnson. And, man, I want to, Chris, and I know you are right there with me on this, man, but Monty Jones, Bomani Babatunde Jones, man, just a big fan of his. And the rabbit. I hear by W, the rabbit. He didn't know who that was. It was Ali talking to Floyd Patterson. But the rabbit, because his life is so fascinating, you can just go down this rabbit hole, this infinite, infinitesimal rabbit hole of information and experiences and all that. And we thank him a lot for coming by here, District.
Quick story about Bomani, man. I ran into Bo like 10, 12, 13 years ago. We were in New York together hanging out. And we had like a great night. We went to a couple parties. Ended up rubbing elbows with a bunch of ESPN folks like Jemele Hill. Then we ended up at another party with like Zoe Saldana and Anthony Mackie, all kind of actors. And so we had a memorable evening. And that dude is one of the coolest dudes, but also one of the smartest and sharpest guys around.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a professor at Duke, like an economics master's degree or something. He was going for Claremont College. And
so that's a hard college. Claremont's a hard college.
Please, please. Super, super hard. And, so just again, thank him for stopping by here, District. So now we're moving on. First thing, you know, Summer League is over with. I don't even know who won the championship. Who cares? But one thing that struck me is a little bit odd, and I'm not going to belabor this too long, but I want to mention this. The MVP of the Summer League, you know who that was this year? Brooklyn Nets.
Yeah, Jalen. Big Jalen. No, I know Jalen. I know Jalen. I'm familiar with him.
How can you be MVP of the league, Jalen Wilson, and be second team all Summer League?
Just,
he was second team all summer league, but voted
that
MVP.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
I just want to make sure I'm not alone.
Well, MJ, but it's kind of like the Jerry West in the loss in the NBA Finals. You lose, you give him the MVP. How did that make sense? How does it ever make sense? Hold on. How does
That's
it ever
stretch.
Make sense? How does it ever make sense to give
it's
the MVP?
Stretch.
But how can you give the MVP to the losing team? No, it's not a stretch.
Jerry West averaged 40 a game in that series,
but
dude.
That was one of the numbers. So they've had Jordan. You've had people that have averaged high numbers for series that won't be named MVPs in finals that average the most points. You can look it up.
I'm just saying, you can't say it
like it's just a – we're supposed to accept that like that's a normal thing.
Well, I mean, so
that's the one of the biggest travesties in NBA history that a player from the championship team didn't win the MVP. Come on, man.
And this may be the seventh game against the Sixers around 1981. Yeah. I had 36 and 12. We lost the game by one, but I was voted player of the game by Britton.
Come on, man. Like, but you see, they stopped doing that. Hey, come on. That's not fair.
And our player of the game is Marcus Johnson and on the losing team.
But I mean, that's anyway, fair. So, that's fair. Bitter, but it's like,
bittersweet. It was bittersweet. All right, so let's talk about the Olympics. So, and I want to make this point, too. 1976, I boycotted. Yikes. I boycotted the Olympics because of the apartheid issue in South Africa. A group of African nations got together and boycotted. And you know what really spurred me to boycott?
What?
I went to a Gil Scott-Heron concert in 1975-ish at the
Revolution
Rocks.
Won't be televised, guys?
No. Johannesburg. What's the word? Tell me, brother, have you heard?
Wait, it's like Thunderbird? Is that where they got Thunderbird?
What's the word?
Johannesburg. Oh, okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think it was the other way around, but it was what's the word, Johannesburg, and so. But Gil Scott-Heron went to see him. He saw myself and a teammate who I won't divulge his identity for what I'm about to say, but he saw us in the audience, and he invited us backstage before they came on. So we're back in the dressing room or whatever, and they start. So Gil starts talking to me about South Africa, apartheid, how important it was for athletes to take a stand.
Wow.
Then they broke into this song, Johannesburg. I don't even know if it was out yet. Broke into the song, gave me one of the little shaker things. I'm shaking. What's the word? Johannesburg. So I'm back there just having the greatest time of my life. And so when it came time for the Olympics in 1976, I decided that, you know, I wasn't going to play. There was a personal decision. And the guy that was advising me at the time, Sam Gilbert, a lot of people that know about UCLA athletics know about Sam Gilbert, and not in a positive way so much, but Sam advised that I kind of keep it on the down low. He thought that would help hinder my draft prospects if people thought I was just kind of over the top revolutionary or whatever. But so that's why I didn't play 1976. My coach Gene Bartow tried to call Dean Smith. He wanted me to play. Let me call Dean Smith for you, Marcus. I can get you on the team. I'm like, no, coach, I'm good. I'm good. This is something I really believe in. So boycotted 76, which I look back on now. I mean, I'm glad I stood on principle, but when I saw how much fun Adrian Dantley and Scott May and Quinn Buckner and Phil Ford, and Sugar Ray Leonard, that was his Olympics in Montreal.
It also, I mean, you did stand on a principle, but it also kind of puts you out of that crowd of in-crowd guys, to keep it real. Yeah. To keep it 100, right. Like those guys, like talent-wise, it was not the same, but being in the in crowd matters in basketball.
Well, it does. But the thing that they talk about in crowd, when you look at the guys on that roster, I don't know if there was anybody west of the Mississippi that was on that team. It was all North Carolina guys and Indiana guys.
And that's
and
what they would used to do that. That's no, what no, they no, would used just, to do that.
That's what Dean Smith, Steve Shepard, I think Steve the Bear Shepard out of Maryland. So you never heard of him but he was a good 6'5", kind of, you know, poor man's Adrian Dantley back in the day. But they kept it kind of.
So you had a standing invite. You had a standing invite,
yeah.
MJ? They said, hey, MJ, we want you.
We want you to come to the Olympic trials. We want you to come to the trials, turn them down. They kept pressing me,
But
I was mad, but you know, I was on my thing, man.
You made a marijuana-infused decision with, hold on, off of a session with Gil Scott-Heron? Like, dog, I'm not rolling with that.
No. I did my due diligence. You know, I did my due diligence. I realized, like, the policies in South Africa, the apartheid situation. Your paper, all that.
I'm proud of you. We were plugged in.
At UCLA, you can imagine, we were plugged into all that political activism back in the day.
I'm proud of you. Especially after Bill and all that.
Bill Walton. Yeah, the war, the Vietnam War, and the protests. So this was, like, our thing back in the day. So the black students really stood behind me on that, and you know, I didn't tell a whole lot of people, but anyway. So now we're talking about snubs, and in the context of the women's United States national team, they had a big game, all-star game. I like the setup.
You have the
all-stars against the team U.S. USA. National team,
yeah.
Team USA,
yeah,
and Team USA got busted, you know,
right.
And so now all of a sudden, Caitlin Clark snub. 10 assists, rookie record, one off the all-star game record of 11. Angel Reese had the double-double. But it was this young lady out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and she turned out to be the MVP, and she did not have a point at halftime. She didn't have a bucket, didn't have 0 points at halftime. Her teammates got into her like, look, you know, whatever's going on with you, you got to let it go. Get out there and do your thing. And Arike Ngumbawale came out there and dropped 34 points, I believe, all in the second half to win the MVP. And she was snubbed. Now, or was she snubbed? I mean, is there still some? I'm not clear on kind of how it went down. What happened with that?
Well, you know, when we talk about Team USA and women's basketball, calling someone a snub, it's hard to say, because you obviously give the committee, which includes like Don Staley and all these other kind of basketball influencers, you give them the respect that their vision and their roster building acumen, from what they've experienced, like, it's the right way. Like, they know the
building
players.
Building a team.
They know the chemistry. They know the players. So I won't call it a snub. I'll call it an interesting choice. A choice I'll call it an interesting choice because, A, when you talk about, let's go from this. So let's call it the interesting choices. To leave Caitlin Clark off the national team is the most interesting choice that I have ever seen in basketball history. I kid you not. It for me, it doesn't make a lot of sense, not even from a basketball perspective. Seeing how Caitlin is able to facilitate, distribute. She's been in a shooting slump. Yes, defensively, she's not the greatest, but put her around 11 or 12 of the greatest players in the world, and she's going to look like an all-star. Arike Ogunbowale was sort of snubbed, but she kind of got wind early on in this Olympic process that she wasn't going to make the team. Now, Arike plays a sort of a 30 in a hurry kind of game. She'll get you 30 in a hurry. And for any if all of you that know anything about people that can get you 30 in a hurry, that means they're going to shoot that thing every time she touches it. So she's got that reputation down in Dallas with the Wings. It's not necessarily the most efficient brand of basketball that's conducive for winning on a championship international FIBA level. So I don't think that she was necessarily snubbed. I think it was an interesting choice. But finally, I'm going to say something here, and it might not be a popular opinion, but I do think that Angel Reese was somewhat of a snub. I feel like Angel Reese on this Olympic team, I feel like it should have been her and Caitlin Clark. And I feel like Angel Reese should have made it, because there's nobody in women's basketball that plays with as much energy, activity, and effort to me than her. I mean, she's the rebounding, the energy, though, when you watch her play, you will see a level of energy that you don't see in any other women's basketball player that's her size playing the game. You just don't see. Nobody's as active as Reese.
When did you come onto the Angel Reese side, man? You were just so anti-Angel and so pro-Caitlin, man.
As a real hooper, as a real basketball player, right, we kind of go through evolutions and you come around the players. You heard me talk about it to Bomani with Steph. Like, I've never been a Steph Curry fan my entire life. But I do – no, not at all. But I do – agree. I'm just not rolling. But I do agree that at this stage, USA basketball is better off running offense through him. I will say that I feel like USA basketball would have benefited some. Now, granted, they're going to probably win the gold. It's going to be a runaway. But give Caitlin and Angel the experience. These are going to be your two figureheads for international Team USA basketball for the next 12 years, right? So give them that experience now. Let them get their feet wet on the international stage.
And to your point, and it's not like they're not balling right now. It's not like it's a stretch. It's not like, you know, you'd have to make this exception and explain to people why we put them on there because we want them to get – they're playing good enough right now to be on the team.
Literally, you have one that's leading the WNBA in rebounding. And you have the other that's leading the WNBA in assists. Not rookies. Not rookie. We're talking about overall leaders are two of rebounds and assists. So your top boards and your top dimer, you could easily make a case to get them on the national team. But that's my take on it, MJ. I'm pulling for the ladies. The team they got is a whip. They're going to dominate. But I would have loved to see Caitlin and obviously – Angel and squad.
Well, and so we're talking about Arike Ngumbawale. Now, what I keep hearing is that, you know, and watching her play, she may be the best one-on-one
no question
player in the WNBA. Now, so let's go to the men's side. Give me your top five. So I'm trying to think of the top five one-on-one men's players. So I got Kyrie. I got Luka. I think Kevin Durant. Jason Tatum, I think I put on there. And maybe even a Jalen Brunson in terms of just being crafty and getting a shot off. Top of your head, give me three or four top dudes, men, one-on-one player.
I'm with you on the same level. Okay. Kyrie obviously stands out as the top one-on-one guy, but also you have to look at Paul George in one-on-one scenarios, his ability to create at his size with the separation, the jumpers, shot making. KD is always going to be KD. And then, look, I'm going to say it again, Steph Curry. You got to look at Steph Curry as one of the most devastating one-on-one players in basketball. Think about what Steph is able to do in terms of off the bounce from where he's able to do it. Now think about you got to guard that. Nobody's is infusing that much fear in your soul as a defender than Steph Curry. I don't care if it's KD. I don't care who it is. Because you got
he
can go to half court. He can go to half court. Dad, he can stand at half court. He could stand at half court and wet you up.
Yeah.
To game of seven. Steph would hit you seven in a row. I'm just saying. So it's, in terms of – we're talking one-on-one. So in terms of one-on-one like that. But on the women's side, I wanted to kind of drop a couple of names that of some young ladies that impressed me. She's the best player in the league. My teammate is her security. But Asia Wilson in a one-on-one setting is one of the most phenomenal players I've ever seen in the women's side. Dad. She is one of the sweetest lefty jumper games that I have ever seen from a women's basketball player. Somebody else who I like that you need to check out is a young lady. I think she played for the Mercury.
Her Kalia name is Copper.
Please. No. Ka.
Kalia Copper.
Ka.
Kalia Copper. Kalia Copper, bro. Kalia Copper. Kalia Copper. Ka. I had her down here. Kalia Copper.
Hey,
I love
Ka.
It.
Ka.
Yeah. Okay.
Is off the hook. She's the type of player that, like, if me, you, and your best friend Air Waters were hanging out, we'd be going crazy about her, talking about her every day of her. I love her game, her attitude, her swag. She has a new shoe with Adidas. Like, she's one of my favorite WNBA players. So Asia, Ka Copper, and then from a one-on-one perspective, Kelsey Plump can get her stuff off, but Kelsey Plum gets her stuff up. I like Jewel Lloyd. I really like Jewel Lloyd, man. I'm enamored with her game.
Yeah.
I'm enamored with her.
Okay. Deep dive. I gotta admit, I'm not completely
check
up
her
on
out.
Jewel Lloyd.
Check her out.
Deep dive on Jewel Lloyd. Kelsey Plum works out with a guy by the name of Chris Hippa.
I didn't know Kelsey. She's from Washington.
Washington.
So that's why
Chris is down in Tacoma. And so he's worked out Cyrus, your younger brother worked out Shiloh. Whenever she's in town, he'll work them out. But he's worked out a bunch of the UW men and women. But he's just a great skill development guy. But he spent a lot of time. And Kelsey's been dropping in high school. She was dropping 50s and 60s.
If you remember, she was the all-time leading scorer in women's college basketball.
Was she?
Until Caitlin Clark broke her record. Wow, I believe that was the record Caitlin Clark broke. But Kelsey Plum put over 3,000 points. No, she is a legit. She's been struggling a little bit lately, but, you know, she's the type of person, like, you know, when she gets it going, it's tough. It's tough to stop.
So, man, that's a good list. That's a good list. So I just wanted to check in with you and agree with you on Caitlin and Angel being left off the team. It could have, you know, I kind of vacillated back and forth. But when you look at the numbers and how they're playing and the way they're dominating their positions, you got to roll with that. So, but it's always fun, man, talking about these ladies. I always want to give them their props, give them their airtime because they're doing such a fantastic job and just making the WNBA the W. Do you call it the W yet?
I don't call it the W. I call it the WNBA.
Okay.
But I do call the NBA the MNBA, like a lot of WNBA fans do. They call the NBA the MNBA.
Like the men's.
Yes. They're so sick for that. I love the fact that they do that. No, but Dad, you gotta just like accept it and laugh at it, okay?
Yeah. All right. I guess that's what we'll do. I'll work on that until our next show next week, and I'll come back in the whole mindset of acceptance and embracing the MNBA. Anyway. Here, District, I'm the captain of this vessel. My first mate, Chris Johnson. Thanks to Bomani Jones. And we will come back next week with all kinds of stuff right smack dab in the Olympic Games. So no telling what's going to be going on in a few days. So we'll talk to you then. Here, District, fantastic voyage.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.